It's Thursday, June 18th. The Fed is navigating a volatile transition. The Russian Navy is testing boundaries in the English Channel, and the market is finally realizing that acquisition rumors aren't a substitute for actual profit. We're also looking at why the obsession with doing more is killing your productivity, and why the sports world is turning into a giant commercial billboard. Let's get into it. Section: National and World News. The Federal Reserve is currently in a period of intense internal debate regarding its communication strategy. While Jerome Powell remains chair, there is significant reporting on the influence of board members like Kevin Warsh, who has been vocal about the need to move away from the Fed's long-standing policy of forward guidance. The discussion centers on whether the Fed should slash the official policy statement and move away from the dot plot to avoid overcommitting to rate paths that are contingent on shifting data. The market is reacting to this uncertainty. The S&P 500 recently saw a decline in value, and Treasury yields have been fluctuating as investors grapple with the possibility of a shift toward strategic ambiguity. The core of the debate is whether the Fed should act as a babysitter for Wall Street, providing maps for interest rate hikes, or if it should force the market to react to hard data alone. If the Fed removes the guardrails, the result isn't just more efficient price discovery, it's increased volatility. Speaking of things getting nervous, let's talk about the English Channel. A Russian warship recently fired warning shots at a British yacht in international waters, which, honestly, sounds like the setup to a bad joke, but it's actually a symptom of a much shittier situation. Russian frigates like the Admiral Grigorovich have been operating in the Channel and the North Sea with their transponders turned off. They're basically lurking in the dark to escort a shadow fleet of oil tankers that are trying to dodge Western sanctions. The fact that they use small arms on a civilian boat instead of following standard naval signaling protocols suggests the Russian Navy is running on pure, unadulterated paranoia. The Royal Navy is stretched thin, constantly forced to shadow these vessels. It's a classic case of resource exhaustion. The British are trying to play a high-stakes game of enforcement, but the margin for error is shrinking by the day. We're in a gray zone now, where a miscalculation by a jumpy commander isn't just a possibility, it's becoming the baseline. While we're on the subject of shifting global dynamics, the US is currently staring down what looks like a decade of institutional decline. This follows the recent, highly contentious standoff in the Persian Gulf. Naval assets were forced to pivot away from a planned escort mission after failing to secure a formal diplomatic guarantee for safe passage. The US is trying to have it both ways, projecting existential threats while the domestic economy decouples from national identity to chase global capital. We're seeing a classic overshoot scenario. The administration is committing resources it doesn't really have, while regional allies, watching the U.S. struggle to secure decisive outcomes, have started hedging their bets. It's not just foreign policy, though. The systemic issue is the financialization of the U.S. economy. When you've got unsustainable debt levels, the only move left is to inflate the money supply, which just fuels more domestic populism. The governing class is increasingly insulated from the economic reality that the rest of the country is living through. They're prioritizing performative politics, using government space for corporate branding, or relying on non-binding memoranda instead of actual enforceable agreements over the boring, nitty-gritty work of governance. It's a pattern we've seen before, oddly enough. If you look back at the Reconstruction era, you see similar tensions. President Andrew Johnson tried to bypass democratic norms to protect a status quo that the war had already supposedly ended. Back then, it took independent investigators like Carl Schurz to force the truth into the light and bypass a compromised executive. The takeaway from that period, as Frederick Douglass famously pointed out, is that democracy isn't a self-correcting machine. It's a human creation that requires active, principled leadership to keep it from drifting into autocracy or total disarray. Right now, we're seeing a move away from expertise toward a model of personal loyalty within key government agencies. That's not a recipe for stability. It's a recipe for a vacuum of competence. And if you're looking for a different take on why we're here, Vice President J.D. Vance has his own theory. He argues that we're suffering from a collapse of early life anchors, family, faith, and local community. He's skeptical of the hyper-rational, secular technocracy that's been running the show, arguing that when you replace shared human values with abstract metrics, you end up with a fractured, atomized population that's easily radicalized. Vance is pushing for a radical, pragmatic approach to things like AI, suggesting that we should treat workers as stakeholders, maybe even giving them state-owned stakes in AI firms, to prevent the kind of extreme inequality that historically leads to social upheaval. It's an unconventional argument, especially coming from someone who pivoted from a Trump critic to a core ally. But his point is that the old institutional norms were rigid and, frankly, weren't serving the national interest anyway. Whether you buy the collapse of faith argument or the systemic financialization argument, the common thread here is that the U.S. is at a structural inflection point. We're currently in a period where leadership messaging is becoming increasingly divorced from factual reality. The energy markets are feeling this too. Recent diplomatic tensions in the Strait of Hormuz have kept markets on edge, but don't count on cheap oil anytime soon. We've entered a high volatility regime. The world has institutionalized a security premium on every barrel of oil. The conflict has accelerated the shift toward alternative energy too. China's crude imports dropped significantly, largely because they're leaning into electric vehicles and fuel switching. That's the only thing keeping prices from hitting triple digits. We're seeing a structural change where high prices don't just cause a temporary blip, they trigger permanent demand destruction. So here's the thing, we're living in a world where the old maps are being burned. The Fed is opaque, the maritime lanes are bordering on hostile, and the political class is more interested in performative signaling than systemic health. It's a hell of a time to be paying attention. But if there's one lesson from history, it's that the system doesn't fix itself. It only happens when people stop waiting for the official word and start looking at what's actually happening on the ground. AI news. The era of unconstrained AI experimentation is effectively over. We've moved into a phase defined by high-stakes regulation, infrastructure control, and the messy reality of integrating agents into actual business workflows. Let's start with the regulatory landscape. The federal government has been increasing its scrutiny of frontier models, focusing on concerns over jailbreaks and unauthorized access. While there is no public record of specific model shutdowns like Fable or Mythos, the administration is clearly moving toward a more restrictive compliance framework. This creates a massive operational risk for any company trying to build on these models. The result is a growing sentiment that the government is prioritizing political optics over technical reality, which is already driving talent and capital to look toward more stable jurisdictions. Meanwhile, if you're looking at the big tech moves, the industry center of gravity is moving away from just having the best model to controlling the entire pipeline, from compute all the way to the application. If you have the proprietary infrastructure, you win. It's that simple. Even OpenAI, which has been the poster child for the growth-at-all-cost narrative, is showing signs of a maturing, if complex, business. Their 2025 financial disclosures show a net loss of $38.5 billion. Sounds catastrophic, right? Well, that figure is heavily inflated by one-time non-cash accounting adjustments related to corporate restructuring. When you strip that away, the core inference business is actually showing strong profitability. Revenue is outpacing direct costs, which proves that selling AI tokens is a viable business model, even if the training costs remain astronomical. But for the average business, the news isn't about training the next big brain. It's about how you stop treating AI like a shiny toy and start treating it like an operating system. Data shows that the most successful firms are moving away from the single vendor trap. They aren't putting all their eggs in one basket or one model. The top 1% of spenders are now utilizing an average of 8 different vendors, using smart routing to send specific tasks to the most efficient model for the job. They're also realizing that AI isn't going to kill the SaaS subscription model. It's just going to change how we interact with it. Despite the token maxing panic, most firms are still in the early adoption phase, spending about $11 per employee monthly. AI is acting as an interface layer, letting you talk to your existing tools like Salesforce or Figma, rather than forcing you to click through a dozen menus. There is a clear divide forming in how organizations handle this. On one side, you have companies that are still measuring activity, token counts, lines of code, the vanity metrics. On the other side, you have companies focusing on business-accepted outputs. If you're just layering AI on top of old, broken processes, you're just creating AI slop, a fancy way of saying you've automated your own inefficiency. The companies that are actually going to survive this transition are the ones building proprietary harnesses around these models, capturing their own reasoning data to build a knowledge base that a competitor can't just copy-paste. It's worth noting that Google is sitting in a uniquely dangerous position for the rest of the market. While companies like OpenAI and Anthropic are fighting to justify their token economics, Google can afford to treat AI as a loss leader to drive their cloud infrastructure. They don't need the AI to be the profit center, they need it to be the reason you never leave their ecosystem. Ultimately, we are seeing the forced redesign of human roles. If your team is spending their day prompting rather than managing agent-driven results, you are already behind. The future isn't about who has the cleverest prompt. It's about who has the most resilient, model-agnostic workflow. Because if your entire business strategy relies on one vendor, and that vendor hits a regulatory wall or a compute outage, you aren't just having a bad day. You're out of business. Royal Ascot Day 3 is here. And for anyone looking at the card, the strategy boils down to a pretty stark split between the marquee group races and the chaotic handicaps. In the elite events, specifically the Gold Cup, the play is to back proven class. Horses like Kyprios are the standard here. Their ability to handle the distance makes them incredibly difficult to beat, even at short prices. The play isn't necessarily to chase high-odds winners in these top-tier races, but to find value by pairing a favorite with an each-way long shot, like an Alnair at 66-1, to hedge against the rare upset. Then you've got the handicaps like the Buckingham Palace. With fields pushing 32 runners, these races are essentially noise. The advice here is to keep your wallet closed, or at least keep your exposure minimal. It's better to focus your capital on races like the Hampton Court Stakes, where the form is cleaner. In that field, a horse like Maho Bay at 10-1 is being flagged as a high-value contender, specifically because bettors might be over-indexing on a poor previous performance. There's also the institutional side of things, which is where it gets interesting. Real-time performance from major yards like Charlie Appleby's acts as a barometer for the rest of the meeting. If a key rudder like Notable Speech fails to land, that ripple effect should force you to reevaluate the entire stable for the remainder of the week. If the big money isn't firing on Tuesday or Wednesday, don't blindly trust them on Thursday. Shift your focus to other trainers who might actually be peaking. Basically, Royal Ascot is a lesson in tiered risk. You anchor your portfolio with the predictable class of the group races, and you treat the big field handicaps as secondary, high-variance gambles. Which honestly, is the only way to play it if you don't want to go broke by the fourth race. It's easy to get sucked into the anything-can-happen narrative of a 30-horse field, but that's usually just a polite way of saying you're throwing money into a wood chipper. The discipline to ignore the messy, high-volume races in favor of the ones where you can actually map out a horse's potential, that's the difference between having a fun week and having a shitty one. And don't sleep on the trainer performance data. People love to talk about gut feelings at the track, but when a massive stable starts underperforming, that's not a streak of bad luck. It's a signal. If the heavy hitters are off their game, follow the pivot. It's not about being contrarian for the sake of it. It's about acknowledging that when the institutional favorites are wobbling, the value is almost always hiding with the people who are actually getting it right. The sports media landscape is currently undergoing a fairly aggressive, if not outright cynical, pivot. Networks are increasingly treating game broadcasts not as sporting events, but as high-end commercial real estate. You're seeing this most clearly at the FIFA World Cup, where Fox has opted for full-screen ads during mandatory hydration breaks instead of the standard picture-in-picture approach. It's a move that's drawing plenty of heat from fans, but the math is impossible to ignore. A 30-second spot during a U.S. match can run you $750,000. Here's the thing. If leagues can successfully rebrand these commercial windows as player welfare breaks, they've effectively found a way to monetize dead air without technically stretching the match clock. It's a clever, if annoying, bit of accounting. We're also seeing a broader structural NFLification of the sports calendar. Major leagues are desperate to keep the conversation going 365 days a year. The NBA is leaning hard into off-season volatility, trades, free agency rumors, and the constant churn of narratives to keep the sport relevant long after the final buzzer. It's a strategy designed to solve the small market problem by focusing on individual star power rather than team geography. At the same time, the distribution model is shifting. Fox's $22 billion acquisition of Roku is a signal that networks are done being tenants. By buying the distributor, they're securing direct access to 100 million households, which fundamentally changes the leverage in future media rights deals. Fanatics, meanwhile, is scaling its own event model with Fanatics Fest, essentially building a content factory that's less about the games and more about the surrounding ecosystem of podcasts and docuseries. While all this is happening, the actual business of managing teams has become a cold, fiscal exercise. In the NBA, the new collective bargaining agreement's apron thresholds are forcing front offices into a state of permanent austerity. We're seeing a shift away from player loyalty towards strict salary management. Teams would rather dump an expensive veteran, often attaching draft picks just to move the contract, than risk the tax penalties. The Sacramento Kings, for example, are currently trying to navigate a $205 million payroll for just 11 players. They're stuck in a position where they have to shed weight without bottoming out entirely, which is a hell of a tightrope to walk. Finally, there's a persistent gap between the data-first approach and the reality of the game. Take the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills. The conventional analytics suggest a bomb-and-gouge strategy, but the course's sloped greens and heavy winds are rendering that approach useless. If you rely on broad metrics that ignore the specific interaction between wind and ball flight, you're going to get burned. The lesson, whether you're a broadcaster, a GM, or a bettor, seems to be that the most reliable edge comes from understanding the actual, messy mechanics of the sport, not just the spreadsheet version of it. Lionsgate shares dropped 4% yesterday. This comes after reports confirmed that Netflix has zero interest in acquiring the studio, a reality check that wiped out the 14% gain the stock had seen, based entirely on rumors. It's a classic case of what happens when the market decides to trade on fanfiction instead of balance sheets. If you were holding Lionsgate because you heard a whisper about a streaming giant swooping in to save the day, well, you're now holding the bag. It's a shitty reminder that an acquisition rumor is not a business strategy. And frankly, it's embarrassing how quickly analysts let that speculative fire burn before anyone bothered to check if there was actually a match. Over in the automotive sector, BMW is having a rougher go of it. Their shares fell 8% after the company issued a formal profit warning. They've slashed their operating margin forecast from a 4-6% range down to a measly 1-3%. The culprit here is China. Local competitors are eating their lunch with aggressive pricing, and when you combine that with rising energy costs, you've got a recipe for a structural nightmare. This isn't just a bad quarter. It's a sign that the premium model built on global dominance is hitting a wall. BMW is finding out that being the best doesn't mean much when your target market decides they'd rather buy a cheaper, local alternative. Then there's Amazon. The Federal Trade Commission, alongside several state attorneys general, is digging into the company's advertising auction practices. Specifically, they're looking at how Amazon discloses reserve pricing. Basically, are they being transparent about what they're charging advertisers behind the scenes? The potential fallout here is a multi-billion-dollar civil penalty. More importantly, if the regulators get their way, Amazon might be forced to overhaul how they price their ads. Considering that high-margin ad revenue is the secret sauce propping up the rest of their massive retail operation, this isn't just a slap on the wrist. It's a direct threat to the engine room of the company. On the flip side, some companies are actually doing their jobs. Lazy Boy shares jumped 16%, because they stopped chasing ghosts and just focused on internal operations. They beat expectations not because of a merger or some speculative hype cycle, but because they actually controlled their costs. It's almost refreshing, right? In a market that's hyper-fixated on the next big acquisition or the next geopolitical blow-up, Lazyboy proved that operational discipline still matters. The broader trend here is clear. The market is currently allergic to potential and is instead pouring money into companies that can show they know how to run a business without needing a miracle. Anyway, the writing is on the wall for anyone still betting on speculative growth. Keep an eye on the upcoming FOMC announcements and retail sales data. We're in an environment where sector-specific shocks are becoming the new baseline. And if you're looking for stability, you're probably going to have to look at the boring stuff, the companies that are just quietly doing the work while everyone else is busy chasing rumors. We're constantly told that the path to a better life is a series of add-ons, more apps, more habits, more optimization. But a few new reports suggest the real move is actually doing less and making things significantly harder on purpose. First, let's look at the idea of high resistance. The argument here is that our current obsession with digital convenience has basically atrophied our ability to handle real-life friction, which honestly is a polite way of saying we've become soft. Choosing uncomfortable, analog, or selfless actions, like doing actual physical work or being there for someone during a crisis, is presented as a way to build genuine self-esteem. It's a strategy to reclaim agency by moving from a reactive dopamine-chasing state to one that prioritizes long-term meaning over immediate digital gratification. On the physiological side, there's a push to treat breathwork as a functional tool rather than just a wellness trend. The focus is on correcting email apnea, that shallow, chest-based breathing we all do when we're staring at screens, to improve CO2 tolerance and oxygen delivery. Whether you're using slow exhales to calm your nervous system or more intense techniques to suppress the neocortex and reset alertness, the goal is to decouple the physical sensation of stress from your behavioral reaction. It's about building a physiological pause so you don't snap at the first sign of pressure. Finally, we have the case for radical subtraction. Burnout is framed as a result of constantly piling on new obligations rather than cutting away the ones that no longer serve a clear purpose in your day-to-day life. Other quick hits, a few other things worth knowing this morning. First, if you ever wondered why MASH felt so jarring, it's because the producers forced a hard rule: no laugh tracks during the surgical scenes. That contrast between the canned humor and the reality of an operating table wasn't just a stylistic choice. It was a pretty brutal way to show that war is, at its core, completely absurd. On the business side, there's a persistent myth that you can coach a thief back into being a productive employee. Look, if someone is stealing from the company, you don't have a personnel issue, you have a liability that's just waiting to blow up again. Theft is rarely a one-off mistake. It's usually just the first time they were sloppy enough to get caught. Hollywood is finally bumping into the ceiling with its obsession over franchises. Studios have spent years betting the house on existing intellectual property instead of funding new ideas, but Gen Z is pretty clearly over the nostalgia bait. It turns out that if your content doesn't feel relevant to the current moment, eventually, nobody gives a shit how famous the brand name is. And finally, we need to stop waiting for inflation to return to those nice, quiet 2019 levels. Between the retreat from globalized manufacturing, the end of ultra-cheap labor, and climate change actively wrecking supply chains, we've built an economic architecture that's basically designed to keep prices high. It's not a temporary glitch, it's the new structural reality. That's the briefing for today. Keep your eyes on the data and ignore the noise. See you tomorrow.